Button. Recording in progress. Awesome. And so I'm just going to jump right in because there's a bunch of these that came in and not necessarily in priority, but let me just dig these up. Okay. Some of these, I'll try to get through. So let's see here. Okay. So here's an interesting one from unnamed. This one's anonymous. I am a Christian. Oh, this is really interesting. This reminds me of what Mother Teresa allegedly said. She apparently, at some event, someone came up to her and started by saying, you know, she's going to ask a question and started by saying to Mother Teresa, "I'm a Christian." And then before she could get even further, Mother Teresa interrupted her and said, "Already?" In other words, like, really? So anyway, I'm a Christian. I don't believe Christianity and hypnotism are compatible. If whoever sent this is here, boy, I would love to hear why you think that's the case. But anyway, if lucid dreaming is a hypnotic state, wouldn't that mean it is being in hypnosis like a person being hypnotized? Okay. Well, lucid dreaming is not a hypnotic state. It's actually an intimation of dehypnosis. If you're in a non-lucid dream, yes, non-lucid dream is somewhat akin to being in a hypnotic state. Lucid dream is actually a form of awakening. It's dehypnosis. So it's a complete opposite of what I hear you saying. And here's something that's really interesting to be aware of. According to the neuroscientist community, especially the work of Bruce Lipton and a bunch of others, mostly from age 2 to 7, but from age 0 to 7. So this is interesting. This is a worth a brief interjection. So from age 0, from birth to age 2, roughly, we're mostly in delta, the deepest dreamless state. And this is why babies are sleeping all the time, because they're in delta. That's what you do when you're in delta. 0 to 4 hertz, you're mostly sleeping. From age 2 to 7, roughly, you're mostly in theta, 4 to 8 hertz. This is what's so interesting here is this is the brainwave frequency correlative to hypnosis. So in other words, when hypnotists, I'm trained in clinical hypnosis. I used it in my clinical work. I used to hypnotize especially children all the time. Children are highly suggestible. I could do all kinds of clinical work without any anesthetic based on just taking them down. It was so easy to do. And so this is so fascinating. Basically, from age 2 to 7, we're mostly in theta. Now, check this out. This is where hypnotists take you down to bring about and implant their post-hypnotic suggestions. Think about this for a second. It fundamentally means that up until age 7, this is not a metaphor. We're literally being hypnotized. This is not a metaphor. We're literally being inculcated, hypnotized in the cult of scientific materialism. In all the belief systems of our families of origin, all the people around us, we are literally being hypnotized. And then what happens is that the rest of our lives, in this kind of stem cell mixing metaphors, dimension of life, the rest of our lives is a readout from these hypnotic suggestions that have been planted by our families of origin and the people around us in these formative years. So this is what it means when the Buddha is the awakened one. Another way to talk about it is the Buddha is the dehypnotized one. We are all asleep. We're all fundamentally hypnotized. And what this means is a topic way too much that I can get into here. But the idea here is it's not hyperbole, it's not metaphoric. We're hypnotized in theta. And our lives are just basically readouts of these post-hypnotic suggestions that are placed. So if you're here, whoever asked this, I would love to hear why you believe that Christianity and hypnotism are not compatible. That's just a very interesting statement to me. But lucid dreaming is not a hypnotic state at all. It's lucid dreaming is a dehypnotic state. Non-lucid dreaming is the hypnotic state. Okay. Okay. From Derek. For me, the selfing. Okay, I'm going to just run commentaries. I go through these. For me, the selfing, which is what the Hindus refer to as Ahamkara, which is I making. For me, the selfing is something that I do intermittently, paren. No, you do it all the time, Derek, rather than something that I am. So, yes, so selfing is definitely something you do. It's not what you are. it's a construct. The self-sense is a construct. I would argue right off the bat, Derek, you don't do it intermittently, my friend. You do it all the time. Read the brilliant genius book on this is Evan Thompson. I interviewed him on my Edge of Mind platform, which at that point was still under nightclub kind of framing. But listen to the interview I did with Evan Thompson. I've known him for a long time. And his amazing book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self and Conscious, Self, what is it? Hold on. Self and Consciousness and Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. A must read for the academic types. This is a brilliant book. And in this book, he riffs really elegantly on this process of ahamkara, I making, and how the self is made. It's a construct, how the self is constructed and deconstructed in all these different states, waking, sleeping, dreaming, dying. It's a tour de force. So back to you. For me, the selfing is something that I do absolutely positively rather than something that I am. Spot on. But you don't do it intermittently, my friend. You do it all the time. It's a construct made at lightning speeds constantly. The only time it completely falls apart, partially falls apart in the dream state, liminal space, completely falls apart in the deep dreamless space, which is why we black out. We don't recognize it for just this reason, because the self is no longer being made up at that point. Back to you. The Buddha, right, the ultimate lucid dreamer, thoroughly deconstructed the self-illusion into its constituent parts. Absolutely. Into the five skandhas, everything else that you talk about here, thoughts, perceptions, memories, he totally did that. He was a demolition derby, this guy. Back to you. After this illusory me dance finishes and the apparent body dissolves, what's left? Or even could be left to get reborn? Oh, this is such a great question. Well, this is, again, a really big question that can be addressed in relative and absolute perspective. From an absolute perspective, what gets quote-unquote provisionally reborn is pure formless awareness itself, that which never dies. And so on an absolute level, what is, you can't even say it gets reborn because it doesn't die. It's not reborn. In fact, in many ways, that's the Buddha's goal, to discover that which cannot die because it was never born. So on one level, what continues, what gets, I would say, even deeper than reborn, what continues is pure formless awareness. In the Theravada tradition, it's called Citta Santana. In Mahayana traditions, it's called Buddha nature. In Vajrayana Buddhism, it's called Machikpatigle, the indestructible continuum. That's pretty straightforward to say, not so easy to actually experience, but it's super important, Derek, because it's the only thing, quote unquote, that exists. Hard stop, period. That's it. That's it. Awareness. That's it, period. What creates the illusion of a separate self-sense in the waking, dreaming, sleeping state, and again, this is where Evan Thompson's book is so brilliant, are basically various degrees of contraction and expansion of this formless awareness. But there's nothing else but this formless awareness. So from a relative point of view, what gets reborn involuntarily, again, this is another really big topic, what continues, it depends on the school. The most elegant description of this, Derek, that I subscribe to is the Yogacara teachings on the eight consciousnesses. And it's the eighth consciousness, the storehouse consciousness, also known as the Alaya Vijnana. That's what gets reborn. So this may not be a completely satisfactory answer, just because to really unpack this requires a heap of time. It's just a great question that requires to really answer it in a satisfactory way. Requires some real time. This is what I do in my Bardo programs. So when I'm teaching, especially on the karmic Bardo becoming, we spend the better part of an entire day trying to answer this question. So again, after this illusory me dance finishes, this apparent body dissolves, what's left to get reborn? Absolute perspective, formless awareness itself, the three terms I gave you. From a relative perspective, Trungpa Rinpoche, how did he famously answer this? Your bad habits. Your habits are what are reborn. In the same way that what takes place every night in the dream state, if you don't attain lucidity and take control over the dream, what takes rebirth? What shapes your mind? What forms this formless awareness? Your habits. That's just a Western rendering of the word karma. So I'm going to leave it at that, just because if I run down this rabbit hole, we're going to be here all evening. So great question, Derek. I hope that at least is a shot across the bow. Okay, this is from Ilya, I guess, if I pronounce that properly. My apologies if I don't. Hi, Andrew. In your book, Yoga of Dreams, actually Dream Yoga, you describe an exercise called the throat visualization. Yes, this comes from the Bun Buddhist tradition and also the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. You'll also find analogs in Christian mysticism. You'll find analogs in Jewish mysticism and Sufism for sure. It's not just Tibetan Buddhism. After I got acquainted with this exercise, I had a question: how to visualize the red syllable ah or the red pearl in the throat? I can imagine myself seeing an object in front of me, but how can I imagine myself seeing a part of myself if with my eyes open, I can only see this part in a mirror? Should I visualize my throat and syllable as if I'm looking at them from the side? This is a really interesting question. So I always ping out references here because I can never exhaustively answer these great questions. I write about this with some rigor in the book Dream Yoga. I'm pretty sure it's in this book. Look deeper into that chapter when I talk about the visualization thing. And I'm quite sure I talk about the ways to work with this and what's actually taking place. So in terms of just practicalities, the way to do this is to, okay, there's good old wonderful Barry. He always puts up his little icons and screenshots. That's great, Barry. So this is what he just put up there. That's the Tibetan syllable, ah. You visualize the only small thing, Barry, is, you know, it's a red. So it's a red. This is the red ah. It's the frequency vibration of the throat chakra. That's where the dream consciousness abides. In fact, when we're in the dream state. So you visualize either that in red or AH in red or red pearl. Or if you really want to get more sophisticated, the red lotus visualization, the descent. So the way to do it, you start by doing it. There it is. You start by doing it in front of you with a pen and paper. Well, actually, no, even before you do it in front of you, when I'm doing the training, what you do, there you go, is you just trace it out like a kid with a red crayon, tracing out the image of the lotus. So you want to get a feel for it. So you work with around it, you work around it, you write it down. This is amazing. You guys are the best. Fantastic. So you trace it out, you trace it out, you trace it out, you trace it out, you get a feel for it. And then what you do is you close your eyes, or there's several variations. One is you can do it, you can then take the visualization as you're working with it on the paper. You can put your finger out in front of you. You can use your finger to trace it out to get a feel for it. Then what you do is you close your eyes. You visualize it in front of you with your eyes closed. You trace it out that way. And then the next step is, fourth step, rather crash course here, is you then bring all this to your throat. And this is where it gets super interesting. Because of the way we have this locus of identity, the scientists have actually studied where most people feel their sense of self exists. And perhaps not surprisingly, it's a couple of centimeters or an inch or so above the eyes, above the brow, and basically where the mystical traditions would talk about is the third eye. And so this is very interesting. I think it has to do because of the way we locate ourselves using vision. I mean, vision is the most dominant sense faculty. We basically situate ourselves in the world because of this sense faculty. So to me, this is no surprise that the sense of self and therefore the visualization that we're going to be talking about seems to arise from here, but it doesn't. And this is where it gets really interesting. And so when you do the visualization at first, yes, provisionally, it's okay to imagine, just because we see everything from up here, that you're looking down with the mind's eye, right? The mind's eye doesn't really exist. It's just your mind. You're looking down to your mind's eye and visualizing this lotus at your throat. Initially, this is the way it starts. Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche says exactly the same thing with his teachings on this visualization. But what's actually happening, this is all an illusion. It just seems that you're visualizing from here down to here, but that's actually not what's happening. What's actually happening is the mind is taking on the shape of this visualization, provisionally located up here, but it's actually taking place in cognitive space, which is not located in space and time. It subsends space and time. And so again, like these other questions, boy, to unpack this one takes a little bit of time. But the whole visualization thing is colossally important. It's a really big deal topic because what you're doing with the process of visualization is you're voluntarily shaping your mind. You're voluntarily shaping formless awareness into a shape. It's like a voluntary reincarnation process. And so you do that with the throat, and what you'll notice is when you're starting to do the visualization, there seems to be mind's eye looking down here. That's fine for starters. But eventually what you will notice is the mind will actually drop the sense of perspective, the perceiver perceived, that dissolves because that's an illusion. And then eventually what happens is the mind will actually drop from this location here into the lotus itself. So in other words, the lotus then perceives itself. You're no longer really looking at it. And if you really think about it, just like in a dream, there is no mind's eye to look at this. The mind is just looking at itself from this illusory, delusory perspective. You think you're looking at it from here to here, but that's an illusion. What's actually happening is the mind is looking at itself. So again, this is like, what is this guy talking about? Well, this is really an intimation of non-dual perception. But the more you do this, the more you'll realize this. This is a really cool part of dream yoga. The more the mind will actually start from here, the mind drops, drops, drops. And then what happens is you're no longer visualizing the lotus, you become the lotus. You become the lotus. That's the point. So I think, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's in Tenzin Wangyal's most recent book, The Tibetan Yogis of Dream and Sleep. He also talks about this. I know he does for sure. I'm not 100% sure it's in that book. I'm pretty sure it's in my book, Dream Yoga. I haven't looked at that in a while. But those are the ways that one works with it. And your question is a really good one. And hopefully this, again, brief response to a really great question if there's some benefit. These questions are great. We could just spend the whole time with them. Okay, from Marion in Montana. This is actually more a question for our sleep doctor, Dr. Ed, but I can take a brief crack at it. Changes in the light come quickly in Montana. I noticed the shift from July to September in particular, and I sleep more in the morning with the later sunrise. Yes, this is the process of circadian rhythms kind of resonating with our sleep patterns. The suprachiasmatic nucleus. I also seem to sleep more deeply, less hypnopompic dreaming this last week. Yes, that's quite common. Is this idiosyncratic or simply transitional, something that will even out? Well, this is difficult to say. I mean, it sounds like you've just recently moved to Montana, because otherwise you would be able to answer this question yourself. If you've lived in Montana and gone through this, then you would know if this is something that's evening out or not. This is a difficult thing to say. Back to you. Note, my dream practice is just over a year old and doing well. I'm 76, so maybe what I'm seeing is also a function of age. Absolutely, positively could be that. Cheers, much enjoy all your Q&A insights, not to mention books, classes, et cetera. Thanks for that. So, Miriam, this one's difficult without doing a little bit of like even a health history, sleep study type thing. These somewhat more great, wonderful kind of clinical questions, I can just give rough responses. If you are a member of Night Club, this is why we bring our sleep doctor in, Dr. Ed, second Tuesday of every month. These are the questions that we send to him because he's a professional in this arena. But this could be completely idiosyncratic. The fact that you seem to intimate the question that will it even out seems to suggest that you're new to Montana. Otherwise, again, you can answer that question yourself. But these are all pretty classic factors of both aging and also the changes in circadian rhythms based on the changes in light sources. So I wish I could be a little bit more articulate about that, but more information would be needed here in terms of like your general sleep patterns, blah, blah, blah. So if you are a member of Night Club, I can ping this to Dr. Ed and he can take a crack at it on Tuesday, the second Tuesday of November. Okay, this is one from unnamed. Hi, Andrew. This is a question about empowerments in the Tibetan traditions. Yeah, also known as Abhisheka in Sanskrit, Wang in Tibetan. From time to time, I see announcements that a particular teacher, Rinpoche, will be visiting locally and that they will be offering empowerments for particular practices. in addition to general public teachings. Yep, happens all the time, which is wonderful. Some of these empowerments are restricted to practitioners with certain levels of practice, but also some are open to the general public. Correct. I've met people who attend every empowerment that comes through town, and I've met people who tell me I only go to ones my teacher tells me to do and nothing else. I haven't found either approach particularly useful as guidance. In general, can you explain what empowerments actually are? And while I recognize that each person's situation is individual, I'm still wondering if there are some general comments you can make about attending these and what considerations one should have or things that one should keep in mind about them. Okay. Yeah, so this is a very wonderful, rich aspect, mostly in Tibetan Buddhism, but not exclusively. I have attended dozens of these. At a certain point, it almost got somewhat comical because it was like an immunization sheet, you know? It's like, oh, I got my tetanus shot. Oh, I got my Manjushri Abhisheka. Oh, I got my flu shot. Oh, I got my Padmasambhava Abhisheka. It actually was like, okay, I was just like clicking them off, clicking them off, clicking them off. It was like, I just couldn't get enough. So here's the way to relate to this. When you say you haven't found either approach particularly useful as guidance, I would then have to ask you where you are on your path. Are you a student of the Tibetan tradition? What type of guidance are you looking for? Because both of the responses that you share are, they're actually quite appropriate. So the first one is, I only go to the ones my teacher tells me to and nothing else. So if you have a teacher and you really kind of have subscribed to their curriculum, then that is the way to do it. Then you just check in with them. If they're doing the empowerments, and they usually do attend those, if you're interested, just like this person is saying, you ask them, and if they feel it's appropriate, you can go. Empowerments are there. This is another wonderful big topic. There are a number of different types of empowerments. It's called the Vas Abhisheka, the Prajnajana Abhisheka, the Word Abhisheka. There are different levels of empowerments. But here's the deal. Some of the empowerments, they become restrictive in the sense that what an Abhisheka does, what a Wang does for a Tantrika, for a Sadhaka, for someone who's doing a relatively lofty, I say that in quotation marks, Vajrayana Tantric level practice. These empowerments are super important. This is how you enter the mandala of the deity. This is how you're given the what's called the transmission to recite the deity's mantra, to visualize the deity. And in order to do all that, the empowerment is absolutely positively critical. And then what comes with that is what are called samaya vows. So that, again, this gets pretty deep into the whole tantric thing. So if you're not a tantrika, this stuff, the best way to approach this, if you're not a tantrika, is as a blessing empowerment. And that means you just go as a general public person. You're not making commitments. You're not making a samaya commitment. Generally, the ones that are listed that way will be available. They'll be public. And you go to those just to receive the blessings of the empowerment. So if you're at that level, then it's a really wonderful thing to do. If you're at the more kind of tantric Vajrayana level, then the empowerments, those will usually be guided by your teacher and then or restricted by the person who's giving it. But here's what happens with these things is they're actually quite magical. Something is absolutely positively transmitted during sometimes these are also called transmissions. Something's actually communicated. And a particular, there's several ways to talk about it. It's another wonderfully rich, vast topic, is that there's a particular kind of potentiality within you, latency, that is represented by the deity, the mantra, the mandala that's created. And so by receiving the empowerment, something is stimulated within you. Something is in a kind of a quantum field effect approach, if you want to use that contemporary languaging, something's actually communicated, and something within the deep structure of your unconscious mind, and this is the super unconscious mind, not the dark unconscious mind, is actually activated. And so, therefore, doing these things, I find they're first of all, they're fantastic cultural events if you've never been to them. Most of them only, you know, that you can get through one of these, if that's the right languaging, within a couple hours. The really big ones like Kala Chakra, those can take up to 4 days. Those are big, massive enterprises. And just to show you how vast this is, like if you want to be reborn in the kingdom of Shambhala, for instance, you do the Kala Chakra Abhisheka. If you want to increase your compassion, you do the Chenrezi, Avalokiteshvara Abhisheka. If you want to increase your cognitive capabilities, your wisdom, you do the Manjushri. If you want to increase your kind of spiritual prowess, you do Vajrapani. There are hundreds of these things because they represent the archetypal nature of our awakened being. And so the transmission kind of tunes in. It creates, again, just metaphorically, stimulates, awakens a particular frequency of your own awakened mind, stimulates it, activates it, allows it to come to the surface. So, so empowerments are beautiful. They're not just cultural events. There's absolutely positively something happening. To go further into this, again, these questions are so rich. It's one of the challenges of these events, these Q&As that I do, is some of these questions are just, there's so much to say. But perhaps that's enough to get you going. They're great. I've attended dozens, and every single one I remember, they're quite impactful. They're quite beautiful. But one has to be a little careful. One shadow side is, in fact, getting on this kind of spiritual supermarket thing where it just becomes like spiritual materialism, right? Like, how many of these empowerments can I actually grab? Well, then you might want to check your motivation. Ego could be stepping in. And all kinds of slippery shadow things can happen. So if you have a teacher, someone you can really bounce this off of, that's always best. But in terms of some general guidelines, perhaps that's of some interest or benefit. And again, anybody who's here that's asked this question that wants more, always best if you can come on, raise your hand, and I can be a little bit more targeted and specific. Okay, so a couple more. Yeah, so early in this year, so this is the nightclub person, you gave us the assignment of falling backwards in a lucid dream. Yeah, so this is something that's a really super interesting thing to do the next time you have a lucid dream. And I made this kind of invitation to the nightclub community, is the next time you attain lucidity in a dream, it's just super interesting to see what happens when, even though you don't have a dream body, you think you do, there's no dream body in there. Again, it's just your mind, but that's aside. When you're in the next lucid dream, just fall back, literally as if you were just falling back in the dream. And then I'm not going to say it. It's open-ended. Just see what happens. So this is what happens to this person. In the dream, I found myself in my childhood bedroom, became lucid and remembered the assignment. Very cool. Good for you. So I fell backward and then found myself in a dark void in which I was carried backward by some sort of current. Really cool. After a while, I decided to try to look at my hands to see if they were still there. Okay, so I'm going to just run some commentary as we go along this. It's a really cool thing to do, Carrie. I'm curious where that kind of insight or inspiration came from. Let me just finish here. When I look at my hands, it was as if I was looking at a glitchy computer screen. The picture of my hands kept turning on and off. Yeah, that's because your hands, which don't actually exist, there are no dream hands in there. There just isn't. Just like there's no dream body in there. It's just your mind. What creates the illusion of the dream hands, what creates the illusion that there's a dream persona and there, a dream avatar, again, that's just your habit. That's a process of rebirth taking place. It's just your habits. There's no dream body in there. There's no dream hands in there. There just isn't. That's an illusion. So when you're looking at your hands and they're kind of popping in and out like that, that's actually pretty awesome. You're starting to actually see the kind of pixelated nature of thought construct. You're actually starting to see, somewhat earlier connected to that issue of eye making, the ahamkara process. In this case, hand making. You're actually making the hand up. And because you're falling backwards, you're heading down towards the major deconstruction zone, which is sleep yoga. This is in fact what often happens is like this, what I playfully call the spiritual Texas chainsaw massacre. where your dream body just kind of starts to come apart. It's just like the coolest thing. It's just so crazy cool. So anyway, what you're sharing here is awesome. I decided to rub my hands together to see if I could feel them. And in fact, when I rub my hands together, I could feel them. Yes, because again, that's habit. Even though there's no hands in there, because of the habit pattern, you think your hands are in there, you think you're creating fiction, but it's all a construct. It's actually not happening. That's relative truth. Absolutely, on an absolute level, that is not what's happening. Then I decided to try to fly around a bit. Also very cool. At this point, I ended up flying around in a warehouse full of boxes. That's interesting. I wonder if that warehouse full of boxes was actually your storehouse consciousness. Could be. Like the ending scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, in which the Ark of the Covenant is taken to a huge storage area with other unknown ancient artifacts. That could very well have been a symbolic representation of your storehouse consciousness. High five. Very cool. Just wondering, did I pass the assignment? I don't know. Depends on what it means to pass the assignment. You know, the idea is just to be an explorer, an intrepid Oneironaut, right? Oneironauts, like they're analog outer astronauts who explore outer space. Oneironauts explore the space of the mind. And so did you pass the assignment? Well, you passed it in the sense that you were actually able to accomplish it. So high five. What I might recommend, let me see. Is there anything else that you would recommend? Yes, doing differently. Would love to hear what your experience. Yeah, I don't need to share my experience, but it's more interesting to hear yours. The only thing I might recommend doing differently next time is just continue to drop. Continue to fall. In other words, as you're falling back, don't engage these other little thingies. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's really actually super interesting. And maybe what I said could be of some interest in terms of what was happening. But this practice fundamentally is one way to go from dream yoga to sleep yoga. So dream yoga is halfway point, the halfway house of the throat. The ultimate nocturnal meditation is sleep yoga, which abides at the heart. And this is why in the Nyingma tradition, sleep yoga is the main practice. Dream yoga is secondary. Dream yoga is halfway to sleep yoga. And so the way I engage this is I fall back as a way to fall down from the wake, from the dream state into the deep dreamless state. And so what I would do next time as a recommendation is fall back and then just don't do any of this other stuff. Just try to completely fall. It's like the mind is actually what it's doing. It's called rongbap in Tibetan. The mind is falling into itself. And fundamentally, it's going to open into wider dimensions of being, as Rumi puts it. And you're going to dissolve into this void, which again is not a void. It's just this infinite black light that is correlative to the luminosity yoga of sleep yoga. So you may want to look. I think it's in, I can't remember which chapters in my book, Dream Yoga. I talk a little bit about the transition from dream yoga to sleep yoga. And I riff a little bit about this sort of thing. So you may want to look a little bit more if you're interested there. Okay, so a couple more from a different document. So hold on, all kinds of cool things came in. Stay with me. Okay, from Domenica. In your dream yoga audio program, you say that in a dream, there is no subject and no object. Yes, I do say that. We experience subject and object in a dream. Yes, we do. That's a construct. It's an illusion. There is no subject. There is no object. It's all an illusion. Back to you. We experience subject, object in a dream. And unless one is truly realized, presumably, even lucid dreams are programmed with the subject-object duality. Well, I wouldn't say they're, I guess if you use the word programmed in the way I meant it at the outset, that our unconscious mind is programmed and conditioned by what happens in these formative, germinative years in our younger years, then yes, we are in fact programmed. We are inculcated, indoctrinated to perceive the world in this what's called threefold impure way, subject, object, consciousness. That's what's called threefold impurity. So yes, even lucid dreams are programmed. They're programmed because of what? Habits. It's just our habits. It's basically your habits are creating this illusion in the dream that there's a dreamer, that there isn't a dream experience, and there's some consciousness connecting the two. There isn't. It's all an illusion. You don't see it when you're lost in the dream. That's why our habit patterns are revealed that way. But you do see it when you wake up, you look back from this perspective onto the experience of the nighttime dream, and you start to ask these questions. Is there really a dreamer there? Is there really a dream object in there? WTF is really going on here? So I devote an entire book to this. So the deepest book in the trilogy, Dreams of Light, I mean, I don't know how many chapters I have on this. This is the essence of this book, The Profound Daytime Practice of Illusory Form. So this is a really big deal thing, because this practice and these types of explorations will eventually break down the subject-object duality thing altogether. So back to you. However, I got the impression that you meant the appearance of subject and object in the dream world is somehow even more unreal than in the waking state. Can you speak further to this? Yes, I can. Yes, they're more unreal if it's non-lucid. So the nighttime dream becomes the double delusion. So the nighttime dream becomes super samsara. It becomes even more deluded than this if it's non-lucid. However, if the dream becomes lucid, then the double delusion, the super samsara, then becomes an opportunity to actually study the machinations and the constructive prowess of the mind, the magnificent capacities of the mind to create this duality. So in a non-lucid dream, as you say, it is more unreal. That's why it's called the double delusion, implicating that this waking state is the primary delusion. And that's what dream yoga is about. This is what separates it from lucid dreaming. You study the double delusion to extrapolate insights into the primary delusion, this, until you get to the conclusion that fundamentally, essentially, they're the same. There's no separation. That seeing day and dream as differing, this is as meditation as it can be, milarepa. But when that dream is not lucid, double delusion. When it becomes lucid, then it becomes a magnificent avenue where we can study the dualistic prowess of the mind and use that to actually cut through into non-duality. And I see that Domenico is there. I'll get to you when I finish my questions. Okay, dear. Great question, by the way. Wonderful. Okay. There's one or two more. Oh, wait, these are the same. Hold on. Okay, so I have to go to one more doc. Give me a second. Because we get some of these buzzer shots, they come in the last minute. Okay, I got that one. That goes. Hang with me. I got that one. That goes. I got that one. Hold on. I got that one. Hey, maybe I'm done. Oh, here's no, not quite. Patrick. What's the difference between consciousness and awareness? Can you define these terms? Yeah. This is a really important question. Definitely connected to Domenico's question and some of the other questions. In the Buddhist tradition, there's a very clear difference between consciousness and awareness. In Buddhism, consciousness, by definition, is always dualistic. And therefore, in contradistinction to consciousness and Advaita Vedanta and some of the Hindu schools, it's a pejorative term. And the best way to say this is, let's just start with awareness. Awareness is, in the Buddhist tradition, there's a number of terms for it, but the most helpful term for us is J-N-A-N-A, jnana. It's basically non-dualistic awareness wisdom. This is the quality of formless mind that knows, that self-recognizes non-duality. So awareness is the highest state. It's called Rigpa in Tibetan, associated with a bunch of other terms, but awareness is the non-dual highest state. It's virtually synonymous with awakening, realization, enlightenment. Consciousness in Sanskrit is, you put the prefix VI in front of J-N-A-N-A, so you've got jnana, or if it's Bengali, it's jnana, harji. And you put the VI, the prefix VI means bifurcated, fractured, divided. Now, how interesting is that? Consciousness is vijnana. It literally is bifurcated, fractured, divided wisdom. And so this is actually, the etymology here is actually brilliant. Consciousness is always dualistic, always associated with subject and object. Awareness, in this tradition by definition, is always non-dualistic. Back to you. I stop at a small town antique store to buy rocks a few times a year when camping. Long story short, I finally met the supplier this year, and he made me an offer I could not refuse. Two Tibetan shamanic wooden masks that were not in the store. I had to go to his house to see them. The masks kind of resemble the masks that from the Jim Carrey movie. Cool. No elaborate embellishments, just wood. Are these used in Buddhist practices? I'd have to see them, Patrick. Generally not. These types of masks, however, are used in Tibetan ritual. So if you're not conflating ritual with practice, there are a bunch of really interesting dances that are done. I've attended many of these that are really quite beautiful, where these masks, but these are not simple. These are quite elaborate. They're masks that typify deities, they're masks that typify different manifestations. So the type of mask that you're talking about, I'd actually have to see them to run commentary. They're not used, at least as far as I know. These types of masks are not used in general practice. Or are they shamanic and tribal in nature? That would be my guess, but I don't really know. If so, do you know what they are used for? I can't say. Camp in the woods near where I bumped them, and it is where I had my first precognitive dream a few years ago. So I find these rare items in a remote U.S. a rural area, very meaningful. Cool. And then finally, a non-sequitorial question. What are the best books explaining Poa? Had to throw that one in there, did you, Patrick? Okay. Oh my gosh, there's so much. Probably the best one, and I know it's controversial, but it's still a great book, Sogyal Rinpoche's The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. He has a fairly extensive riff on what he calls essential Poa. That's the one that I would learn. Because the other types of Poa, they're a little bit more esoteric. You know, they're the five main types of tantric Poa, a little bit harder to get data on that. All the different types of sutra Poa. That type of stuff is a little bit trickier. Chagdu Tulku Rinpoche's wife, and I can't remember her name. Is it Khadra Rinpoche? I can't remember. I apologize. She wrote a book on this. It's in my library around the corner. She wrote a book on Poa. So the best books on it, I mean, I would learn Essential Poa by Sogyal Rinpoche. It's really quite beautiful. I think that's the best way to go. The other types of Poa, really, yeah, you can learn them. You can read about them in a book, but these are practices. These have to be really effectively communicated in with a teacher who actually empowers you to do these, you know, whether it's Dharmakaya Poa, Sambhogakaya Poa, Nirmanakaya Poa. When people usually talk about Poa, ejection of consciousness, what they're really talking about is Nirmanakaya Poa. Then there's called Dream Yoga Poa. It's a more esoteric aspect of it. I think, yes, I write about it. Stage 7 of Dream Yoga is connected to this, creating a special dream body. This is Dream Yoga Poa. You can learn about this a little bit in my book, Dream Yoga, Stage 7 practice. And then there's what's called Kacharya or celestial Poa. This is a kind of devotional yoga, devotional Poa. Outside of that, you know, and I should have pulled this up one earlier and looked at my library. I can't remember the author and the title of the book. It's a female, it's the wife of Chagdu Tulku Rinpoche. She wrote a book on Poa. And if you gave me 30 seconds, I could run around the corner and get it for you. But I just don't remember the full title off the top of my head. Okay, bud. Okay, let's see if there's anything else here. Oh my God, these are great. There's so many questions here. These are great. Oh yeah, okay, I got that one. That can go. I think I might be done. Yep, I got that one. Okay, Alyssa, did I miss any or did I get them all? Let's just say I did. Oh, let me just check this doc and then I can open this up. There we go. Okay. So, Domenica, you were on and then you disappeared. You want to come back on here or are you done? Are you good? Yeah, fire away. Unmute yourself. And then I'll get
Go.
you. Hi.
Hey, it takes a minute. Yeah, thanks so much for taking my question. I kind of wanted to, I don't know, I thought could just kind of riff a little bit on the question I wrote in about the subject-object duality and dreams. When I said programmed, yes, that was what I meant by programmed, just kind of like habitual our habitual way of viewing the world.
Yeah.
And I guess it's such a juicy point, but also hard to kind of, It's so difficult to conceptualize what consciousness, what experience of consciousness would be without a subject-object duality.
Right.
And when I wrote that, it seemed like you meant that the dream experience of subject and object was somehow even more unreal than our waking experience. I was thinking lucid dreaming. So in a lucid dream, even once I've become lucid, because my only way of relating to experience is with subject and object, even once I've become lucid, like that's still what my experience is going to be. But then on a sort of, you know, the level of quantum physics or whatever, or the level of the Dharmakaya, even our waking experience, you could say the same of that. You know, there isn't, supposedly from the perspective of quantum physics, there's no inherent independently existing objective reality out there in the way we perceive it. So, you know, if I as a subject don't exist in the way that I experience myself, where I have the sense of I and here, and then everything out there is other, I guess I'm wondering what your understanding or interpretation of the teachings, then what is I actually supposed to be experienced as the totality of my sensory input? Or are we viewing the totality of sensory input not in terms of oneself, but as just like false inputs? I don't know. Does that even make sense?
Yeah, it does. And these are fantastic questions. They're so great. So this is why, again, I'm just going to ping you to some resources and then I'll run with this a little bit. These are just fantastic. So this whole non-duality nature of mind track that I started in Mexico 3 years ago that I'm now doing in Menla, that whole track is about this stuff. To me, this is the juiciest, richest, most profound stuff in the whole business. I just adore this stuff. So as you might suspect, there's a lot to say here. A couple things. Again, if you haven't read, where I riff about this the most is in my book, Dreams of Light, which is my favorite book. I devote a lot of material to this, especially the chapters on unpacking clear light. You know, like what does clear mean? What does light mean? And then this whole issue of what some traditions, some writers talk about is tantric epistemology. So boy, oh boy, there's just so much to say here. First of all, in terms of the type of dream, so if you're lucid dreams come in a gradation from entry level to really, really advanced levels. And so at relatively entry levels up until you get into the really advanced levels, we in fact do have this reified subject-object threefold impurity dualistic dream, just again because the moniker for dream yoga is what? The measure of the path. It's going to show you where you are. It's going to reveal to you the way you relate to the world. Well, as you progress along the path and you start to work with formless meditations, open awareness, you start to work with non-dual practices, then what happens, you'll start to notice changes in your dream. And eventually, just for purposes of time, you will eventually start to have the highest of all possible dreams before dreaming itself stops. And these are what are called clear light dreams. And this is what Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche writes about it in his book, The Patent Yogas of Dream and Sleep. Check that out. He talks about samsaric dreams, dreams of clarity, and then clear light dreams. Clear light dreams are intimately connected to the very first question or one of the earlier questions I talked about in terms of the visualization thing. And again, boy, this is just, it's not easy to paraphrase this, that with a visualization thing, because that's what a dream is. A dream is an involuntarily karmically driven visualization, taking place in the media of a mind devoid of sensory input. That's what a dream is. It's a form of visualization. Therefore, it's also connected to visualization practice. And so when you're connected back to the lotus thing, when you're doing the visualization, initially you start, you're visualizing the lotus. It seems to be outside of you. You're visualizing it. You're working with it. But just like I said, eventually, when you put the lotus in your throat, And eventually, when you become a little bit more facile with the visualization practice, the mind actually descends from this bifurcated observational point, this witness awareness point, and the mind actually drops into the visualization. And then what happens? The visualization knows itself. The visualization appears to itself. It's called rangregyeshi, it's reflexively aware. That's non-dual knowing, non-dual perception. And everything here has to be in quotation marks, because perception by definition is dualistic. Even traditional knowing by definition is dualistic. So when you get into this domain, which again, this to me is the most enjoyable, profound, I love talking about this more than anything. One has to be extremely careful with language. One has to really take the time to centrifuge things out and realize that when you're talking about non-dualistic phenomena using a dualistic medium, you're screwed. Good luck. Good luck. And so what I do is, as many other traditions do, I just do the very best I can. But eventually what you will discover is your dreams evolve. You will start to have some intimations of these clear light dreams, where what happens is the dream arises in a non-dualistic way. It's hard to put into words. You actually perceive, the dream actually perceives itself. There's no longer a perceiver. And so the point behind all this, of course, is, well, that's kind of cool. That's like some interesting spiritual gymnastics. Well, the point is, again, to take these insights and bring them into this reality, because this is also a dream. And so eventually this leads to perceiving the world in a non-dualistic way. And what that's about, boy, oh my gosh, you can imagine what's involved in teasing this apart. The sensory awareness thing you said at the end, sensory awareness in itself is also dualistic. You know, when you're talking about sensory input, you're talking about a dualistic apprehension of the seemingly external world. So what happens at this point is even what we know as physical senses are radically transformed. This is not metaphoric. You literally see your vision changes. Every one of your sense faculties change in a radical way. And you perceive reality the way a Buddha does, the way an ultimate lucid dreamer does, which is in a completely non-dualistic way. And I realize this is utterly unsatisfactory, but you know, to try to paint something in 5-10 minutes that is among the deepest topics in all the non-dual wisdom traditions, I think you get some idea of what's involved here. So I might recommend you look at my book, Dreams of Light. I have a number of chapters on this. And I think you might find in tons of supporting statements from all these masters, from all these as much outside stuff as I could bring to try to bring some support to understanding what this is, because this is another way to talk about what awakening really is, what realization enlightenment actually is. It's actually perceiving the world in this way. And so, heck, if it was easy, we'd all be awake. It's not. So it just takes a little bit of time. So I apologize. It's the best I can do. It's really tricky stuff and is a fantastic set of questions. So thank you for sending them out there. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay. Hey, Jerry, Katie, and then Carol. Fire away, Dr. J.
All right. you know, at the very beginning of this program, you mentioned mysticism, like in Sufism. And I just like your comments. Yesterday, October 4th, was the anniversary of the death of St. Teresa of Avila. Are you familiar with her at all? You know, yeah. She's a Christian mystic. And, sure. You know, like, I don't know, maybe 40 years ago, I read her book, Interior Castle. And, you know, how much mysticism, I guess you might say, because I was brought up as a Catholic. And this was hardly ever mentioned, if ever. I discovered the book on my own. Do you have any feeling like how her mysticism is, her ecstatic mysticism? Because sometimes they said, like when she was in the chapel, and she went into one of these ecstatic union with God states, she would float up off the ground. And they said some of the nuns she was teaching would have to grab her to keep her from floating up. And once they found her floating up, you know, right at the top of the ceiling of the cathedral, where she was completely absorbed. you know, in a reunion, ecstatic union with God.
Sure. Yeah, fantastic. I mean, first of all, I mean, why not? The one thing that I might just, again, I'm just shooting from the hip here, right? The ecstasy in my experience and also doctrinal understanding is only in direct proportion to the preceding levels of agony. And this is actually somewhat important because I get it. I get the absorption state. I get the samadhi thing. I get the ecstatic thing. But then there's a potential massive near enemy here, because the near enemy of that is that somehow this ecstasy is superior to this spiritual ecstasy, this transcendent, again, intimated by literally floating up, is somehow superior to so-called materiality in the earth. And so here's what I would say, Jerry, and this is just me. The ecstasy is basically, it's only ecstatic because of the preceding level of contraction. So if you're super contracted, then what actually takes place when the contraction opens is in fact the experience of ecstasy. But fundamentally, that ecstasy, when it's acclimatized, when it becomes, you become familiar with it, the very definition of meditation, it actually becomes extraordinarily ordinary. And this is really important, because otherwise, what are you going to do? Are you going to engage in some type of spiritual bypass where you're waiting to achieve the spiritual ecstasy that she seems to portray? So this, to me, seems to suggest a somewhat insidious, damaging cosmological dualism and a theistic approach that to me, I think, is a bit problematic. Because then what do you do with your earth? What do you do with your body? What do you do with matter? What do you do with form? To me, it's like, yes, it's great. Go up to the Dharmakaya, have these ecstasies, reach Turiya, reach the Godhead, reach whatever you want to call it. But if you get stuck there, you're just going to be reborn as a god. This is how you get reborn in God realms. And that's just the penthouse of samsara. That's just the best of samsara. What you want to do then, in my playful language, is you want to put a wicked U-turn, Y-O-U-turn. You take that Dharmakaya awareness, that's what creates the ecstasy, and then you come back into form. You come back into the rupakayas. You come into the form bodies voluntarily out of love, kindness, and compassion to elevate the seeming earth up into that dimension. Because otherwise, these things, and I get it, they're great. They're good marketing. I'm just using speedy language here to get through it. I think they're beautiful. But I also do think they intimate a very insidious, dangerous cosmological dualism that leads to spiritual bypassing. And so to me, it's like, great, high five. But then what are you going to do? What are you going to do up there? It's a little bit like the Gary Larson cartoon, right? You know, I wish this guy would come back. You know, this person has obviously attained enlightenment, or he's in heaven. He's hanging out on a cloud. You know, he's just up there as high as he can be. And interesting, she's flying up. And the thought bubble is, should have brought a magazine. Oh, there it is right there. Should have brought a magazine, right? There it is. Good old Barry. I love this guy. So, you know, that's my riff on it. I think it's great, but I think the spiritual marketing is dangerous. You know, the whole thing for me is the path is perceptual, not actual. Find the spiritual in the material. Don't elevate off. I think the elevation thing, the levitation thing, is an intimation of the Dharmakaya, leaving the form realms to enter the formless realms. I think that's what that's symbolic of. And as beautiful as that is, that's basically just half the show. So that's just my little, wonderful endorsement of the genius of these approaches, but also, I think a reasonable critique of what I see as these insidious spiritual pathologies, bypassing materialism and all that sort of thing. So anyway, that's just me. Okay, bud?
Anyways, yesterday I was reading about, her on Wikipedia.org, because, it's been so long since I had, read the book and heard about her, and no one talks about her, in the Catholic religion. But anyways, it said in Wikipedia that after they buried her, her burial, they reopened the coffin 7 months later. Yeah. And all her clothes had, disintegrated, but her body hadn't. It hadn't. Yeah,
that's not uncommon. There's tons of the data on this. I mean, read the work of Jeffrey Kripal, this religious scholar out of Houston, Rice University. I mean, he rolls in this stuff in the most elegant, rigorous way. Read Blazing Splendor, the memoirs of Tugu Ujin Rinpoche. I mean, the literature, this is not at all unusual. The literature is replete with these sorts of things. And in a physicalist, materialistic world, it's like, boy, this is just pure BS. No, it's not. I mean, this stuff is absolutely commonplace in the spiritual traditions, and why not? Okay?
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry. Nice to see you.
Nice okay. to see you.
Hey, Katie. Hi, dear. How are you?
Hey, Andrew.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. I first just want to say I'm very much looking forward to the Dream Yoga Retreat in 2 weeks with Tenzin
Wangyal. Oh, Tenzin Wangyal. Yeah, he's so cool. He's such a great guy. I am, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a lot of joy that the both of you will be teaching there together. I'm really excited for that.
I love the guy.
Yeah, and so I have a question about the Dream Yoga practice. I've been doing a lot of work for quite a while with, you know, before I go to sleep, I review the day and kind of clear out any karmic traces from the day. And I've just started doing more recapitulation from farther in the past, because I've noticed that generally if I have a non-lucid dream, it's either from the farther past or it's from the future. But it feels like kind of a lot, like there's a lot to clear out. And I'm just curious if there's a most efficient way of doing that. Like, for example, I've been, you know, trying to group together different experiences and kind of clear them all as one rather than doing one by one experiences from the past. But yeah, I'd just love to know.
There's a number of things you can do at the level of body and also at the level of mind and mantra. So starting at the level of mind and body, well, let's just start with mind. And again, mind and body are just dual aspect monism. They're just two ends of the same spectrum. Mind is just very subtle body. Body is just really gross mind. So at the level of mind, there are a number of practices that can help you. Again, depending on how deep you want to go into like tantric approaches. One super powerful one is the practice of Vajrasattva. If you're speaking of empowerments, if you want to get empowerments, Vajrasattva is like the king of all yidams. He's the king of all the deities. And so Vajrasattva, again, I love these, there's these questions. Just they, I stutter and sputter because there's like, oh my God, there's just so much to say. But yeah. Vajrasattva represents the fundamental purity. And so I'll give you one little mantra now that you can do now. Om Vajrasattva Hum. Right, om, literally just that. Om, O M, V A J R A S A T T V A. Om Vajrasattva Hum. You can recite that over and over and over and over. If you want to go a little bit deeper, then you recite what's called the 100-syllable mantra. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manipalaya Vajrasattva Devana Batista. So it goes for 100 syllables. This is an incredibly powerful purification practice. It's associated with a visualization that is designed to clear out what the tradition talks about is dikpa and trikpa, all these, like you're talking about, this residue, these samskaras, these habit patterns that are lodged. So this is just one of quite a host of incredibly powerful, effective means of purification. Probably the most readily accessible one that you could start today. Just literally, as you walk around, just recite Om Vajrasattva Hum, Om Vajrasattva Hum, Om Vajrasattva Hum, Om Vajrasattva Hum. If you want to go deeper into it, you start to have a connection. Then you get the transmission for the preliminary practice of Vajrasattva purification that allows you to do the 100-syllable recitation. To go even further than that, you can get the Vajrasattva empowerment, Abhisheka, Wang. Then you can actually visualize Vajrasattva. You can work with that. It's a super powerful purification thing. The other thing is to work with the inner yogas, because these residues, they're as much visceral somatic at the level of the subtle body as they are cognitive or mental. And so here you can engage in classical yogas will do it, but in particular, purification practices like Lujong, body training, and Trulkor in particular. And actually, interestingly enough, hey, I just happen to have it right here because I was in contact with him today. This book, can you see it?
Yeah.
Super short. It's a wonderful book, Tibetan Yoga for Health and Well-Being by Alejandro Chaul, Chaoul. He's the guy that invited me on behalf of Tenzin Wangyal to go to Virginia. So he's a wonderful dear friend. Short book, wonderful introduction to these inner yogas. These practices are really great. They're super powerful because they go after the subtle body component of these. And so the stuff can reach, you know, this approach, Katie, is really powerful. I'm so glad you were kind of on this track. You can enter it at these more kind of entry levels. This is where I do recommend you start. But eventually, if you want to enter like the thermonuclear dimensions of these, then you do full-blown inner yoga practices that are designed to break loose all these samskaras, these knots that are held in your subtle body system. And so fundamentally, whether we do it through psychotherapy, whether we do it through body work, whether we do it through therapy, meditation, or whatever, these residual, undigested, unmetabolized psychic cysts have to be accessed and drained. I mean, that's part of the 95% of our unconscious mind that rules our so-called conscious life. So one way or the other, this stuff has to come up and out.
Yeah.
And so the entire battery of Nundro practices are also related to this. So this is another one of these massive questions that maybe for now I can put a little kind of a pause on it. One, I'm trying to think of one book that might help you here. Reggie Ray's wonderful book, Secrets of the Vajra World. He has quite a bit. It's a fantastic introduction and overview to a host of kind of tantric approaches to doing this.
Okay.
So I'll pause for a second to see if there's anything else you want to say or anywhere you want to go with it. But that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from you is that I don't actually have to directly go into each karmic trace from the past. But just these generalized purifying the mind, purifying the body practices are an important way of working with it. And I've been working with some of these practices generally, but also just wondering, because I'm like, oh, I just had a dream about something that happened in high school, you know, or like people from high school. So, you know, I guess that'll just over time with these generalized purification practices that will clear out.
Here's what I would do, Katie, is I would engage every skillful means at your disposal. And let me just share a story around this. So there's two ways to work with this, a little bit relative and then the absolute. And so let me just share a story about the absolute. I think I've shared this before. Jigar Khonsa Rinpoche, who I really like, because he's an awesome teacher. I like him because he's edgy. He's a little semi-wrathful. He just doesn't take any crap. I love him because he's like Manjushu. He's just sharp. And he was doing a program, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. I'll never forget it because it was impactful for me. And he was doing it up in Boulder, with a lot of my wonderful, wonderful Naropa friends, and everybody's in this MA Psych program, and they're doing some amazingly fantastic things. I'm not dissing this at all. But by the end of the weekend, all these people were saying, well, I want to process this. I want to work with this. You know, I'm going to do the psychologizing thing. And at a certain point, Zigar Khonsa very gently, but also with a brilliant blade, said, you know, stop the processing. Just cut.
Yeah.
This is the cutting through aspect. So that's one end. Just look at it, burn it, cut right through it. Traction.
Yeah.
However, with that said, let me say this. I think what I would do, this is just the way I roll. Yes, theoretically, these more absolutistic approaches, for sure. Emptiness can handle everything, theoretically, no doubt. But in practicality, what I have found is that some of these really deep intractable issues, like trauma, for instance, or something that's really lodged in your body-mind matrix, boy, oh boy, I would absolutely positively engage with those, like the ones you just can't seem to clear. And you'll notice this with dreams or whatever. There's something really, this baby is stuck. You can do two things. One is work with a contemplative therapist to work through that. And the second thing is psychedelics. These psychedelics, these puppies can really get in there and shake the snow globe. They can really help you dislodge the stuff. Psychedelics, in my estimation now, are a type of inner yoga, subtle body yoga. And I know people are going like, oh my God, you can't say that. Well, I think I could defend it doctrinally. And my experience bears it out. So, hey, here's the way I roll with this, Katie. Life is short. I'm going to pull out every possible plug I can. This is why I do practices that work throughout the night. This is why if psychedelics work, I mean, I hardly ever do it. But if I'm really stuck and something's not working, I got to put a little dynamite in there. I'll use it. Mm-hmm. Therapy, if I need it, if something's really stuck, I'll work with my therapist. I don't care, man. If something's going to help me wake up, if something's going to break things loose and get things moving, I'm going to use it. And so, you know, on one level, this approach is a massive part of the whole path, is just purifying, purifying, purifying. And you can do that from a top-down or bottom-up approach, either through mind working down on body or body working up with mind. It's a bi-directional thing. So I'll let it go for now because this is another really big one, but maybe something like that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Carol. Fire away, Carol. And then I'm going to check the chat column, and then I've got to have dinner.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. Oh, my goodness. So many wonderful, good things that I've been writing down. I love your last suggestion about the contemplative therapy and the psychedelics, because the last Q&A, I had asked you about the fears of being trapped, like in a small tunnel or something. And, you know, I'd have those dreams from time to time. And I could never, you know, it was like, you know. And then it was, I had linked it to that experience of the apperception of the formless dichotomy. So that, you know, that where there was just, you know, no foothold anywhere. And then when the sense of the separate self returned, it was like the moment that it dawns on you that you're like, I'm off the cliff, you know, I'm about to fall, right? So when you told me that it was like, become a Dakini, and that just really percolated in my, and you know, the sky dancer, you know, dance with that. And that really like worked on me. So I've been working with some of the techniques for the lucid dreaming that you present, and also the Claire Johnson's work. Yeah, that you recommended her. And I got in that whole space of re-entering and being trapped in a small tunnel. I asked for that and to not have the fear. And then I just, I did, you know, my spirit just flew. It just flew. And then I realized, you know, that fear of the human instinct to survive actually could be transcended, and that I could fly into the sky because my body form is also formless, emptiness form. So that was pretty exciting for me. You know, I don't know if that's going to, you know, cure everything. I'll see what happens, you know, how that is going forward. Anyway, I just wanted to do a weather report with you on that.
Thank you. That's awesome. Yeah, so cool. So cool. You know, what you may want to consider, and I don't recall if I mentioned this, Judith Zimmer Brown's really beautiful book called Dakini's Warm Breath. If you haven't read that, she's a dear friend. And this is one of the best books on kind of the Dakini principle. Skip the first chapter. It's a little academic, a little heady. She even said that. But start from chapter 2 and read the rest of the book, and you're going to learn a lot about feminine principle and how to dance in space. So I really recommend it. It's a beautiful book. Outside of that, all I can do is just give you a high five and say, beautiful, fantastic. Keep it up.
Yeah. What was the author's name again, Andrew?
Judith Simmer, S-I-M-M-E-R, dash Brown, B-R-O-W.
Oh, okay.
Brown. Okay. Dakini's Warm Breath.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
I've also been working with the White Tara mantra also. So
fantastic. Fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Stay tuned. I was just in contact with my friend who I haven't seen in quite a while, Lama Paulden. She's like the Tara queen, the Tara expert. And so we're setting up, I'm going to be interviewing her for Edge of Mind. I think we have a date set up for like 2 weeks. And so I'm going to riff a lot with her on this Dakini principle, on the deity principle, especially Tara, because she's a real expert on white and green Tara. So stay tuned. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to record that and put it up. She's a rock star. She's super cool. You're going to love her. So
thank you so much, Andrew.
Nice to hear from you. Okay, hold on just a second, Jerry, just to make sure I'm not missing anything here. Okay, some of these have already been addressed. From Tim, Andrew, technically, what is a Lama in Tibetan Buddhism? Lama just means teacher. I've heard it is that if you've done a three-year retreat, you qualify as one. Is that true? And if so, are you a Lama? Yeah, I'm the kind of Lama that carries shit around, right? There's different types of Lama. You know, I'm the kind you put crap on my back. I'm that kind of Lama. If you do a three-year retreat, that you get that, but I those kind of credentials just creep me out, right? I mean, even when people refer to me as a spiritual teacher, it just kind of creeps me out. I'm just a dude that rolls in this area that might have one or two things to say. The whole teaching, but yes, technically Lama just means teacher. Yes, if you do a three-year retreat, you qualify as one. But that's not the reason to do a three-year retreat. Oh, yeah, Chögyal Kagyu. There you go. Thank you. That's it. Chögyal Kagyu. Yes. Thank you, Rhonda. High five. Spot on. Yes. Poa commentary instructions for the practice of consciousness transference. That's it. You are the best. Thank you so much. You are the best, Rhonda. Thank you. Thank you. Between you and Barry, I'm covered. I don't have to do anything. Okay. Excellent. Okay, Jerry, better be quick for a buzzer shot. I got to get some food.
You mentioned psychedelics, and they've been decriminalized here in Michigan, the state that I live in. Right. And there is one place in the United States, I'm sure you heard of it. It's attached to Harvard Medical School, Bayview Hospital or John Hopkins, where the federal government has given EUA, emergency use approval, to use psychedelics to treat, various conditions.
Yeah, this is Roland Griffith's amazing work. Exactly. And also, just drawing a blank. I'm a little tired, I can't remember. But, in Colorado, it's the same. It's not just decriminalized, it's legal. But the implementations and all that kind of stuff has to be obviously very carefully kind of doled out. So again, I've talked a little bit about this. Listen to the podcast I just did. My most recent one was with Chris Timmerman. He's one of the world's, in fact, probably the world's leading authority researching DMT, 5-MeO DMT, and ayahuasca. And so I just interviewed him at Imperial College London. He's a total rock star in this area. So I'll be doing more and more of this sort of thing. Anthony DeBasis, that's the name I was thinking of. This stuff definitely has a place. I don't want to get into it right now because it's such a huge topic, but these agents absolutely positively have a place in places like Johns Hopkins with Roland Griffiths, NYU with Anthony DeBasis, Imperial College. I mean, there's an amazing group of really cool rocket scientists, rocket level scientists that are taking place here that I just love. Stuff definitely has a place. But again, I have to do a disclaimer. In most places, this is illegal, right? I have to do this thing so I'm not sued. my political career is already ruined, so it doesn't really matter what I say on that front. But one does have to be a little careful, categorically endorsing these sorts of things. I'm not doing that. Please understand that. Like this gets out on the public domain. No, I'm saying that these agents with proper set and setting under controlled environments with a guide, they have a place. And when I did the big MAPS conference here, 12,000 people, 300 presenters, even Governor Rick Perry from Texas, right? Like the most conservative person you can imagine. He gave a keynote address. Oh, yeah. And he came out there and people were, you know, he's like, okay, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. Like, why am I here? And he goes, because I trust the data. I trust the science. Seven vets a day are committing suicide. And these agents are saving lives. And so it's just a matter of time we get over this draconian Nixonian BS that shut this stuff down, that if it's done properly this time around, and that's the key, don't screw it up again. These agents really have a place. And there's so much happening in the world right now, but we just have to be careful with these things. So anyway, got to go see you bye. We dedicate the merit. If that means anything to you, always remember, if what we're doing here is not of benefit to others and not of benefit to the planet, what we're doing here is irrelevant. It's just spiritual narcissism. So what we're doing here, always remember, we're doing it for the benefit of others. Never forget that. Never forget that. So at the end, we dedicate the merit. If that means something to you, send it out to all sentient beings throughout the cosmos to be a benefit to them. And then you know where to find me. I'll be back in the usual venues for hanging out with y'all. So much fun to see. Oh, did I miss anything here? I think I got it. Excellent. Great. Nice to see everybody again. Till next time, ciao, ciao.